Hello and welcome to the fifth Saturday Heritage Fair being held at Leicester Adult Education College. I'm Hargesh Farmer, a community reporter for the Ebbington Echo and a trustee of the charity The Friends of Ebbington. There is an electric and eclectic range of exhibitors, volunteers and speakers here today. They're all eager to share their exhibition interests, their enthusiasm for their special interests, and I suppose it's all about sharing private and professional passions with the public. I'm joined here by a volunteer who will introduce herself. I've known her for a long time, but she'll introduce herself now.
My name is Denise, and I volunteer for Ebbington Echo. So today at the Heritage Fair, I'll hold a stand about the magazine, because Ebbington has got magazines every 2 months called the Ebbington Echo, and there you have all the information what events happening in Ebbington.
Thank you very much, Denise.
So I'm here with Ned Newitt, who is a local historian who's published a number of books.
I'm a local historian. I've written several books. The first one I did was on the history of Leicester's Chartist verse and poetry, a very seemingly unusual sort of topic, but it was working men who wrote, they were men, not women, men who wrote hymns in the 1840s and verse, and had them published, and actually published a Leicester Chartist hymn book. And I came across them whilst researching something else, and I thought that'd be interesting to put in a little book, which I produced many years ago. But I've just recently published a book on the history of it's called Housing the People of Leicester from 1900 to the year 2000, and it's a history of social housing in Leicester. Just the council housing, but also housing associations and housing cooperatives as well.
So, Ned, what made you interested in history? Was it just an interest from a young age, or have you always wanted to explore your local area, or what was it that prompted you to do this?
Hard to know, really, but I suppose it comes from having a grandfather who was born in 1842 and a father who was born in 1900, that they were all slightly out of their generation, and they had a sort of sense of history that comes with being, you know, an elderly parent. So yes. I think that may be the case. I don't know, but certainly, well, my family were always interested in history.
So working class people writing hymns and you know, doing stuff that isn't often associated, you know, stereotypically with working class people. You did investigate that as a...
Yes. I mean, it's quite interesting. It owes itself to a Chartist leader called Thomas Cooper, who encouraged other working men to really write and publish, and he was part of the propaganda for Chartism in the 1840s, which was, you know, trying to get working people the right to vote. And the way of doing it, of course, was there was no television, no radio, and little access to printed material. But there were some Chartist newspapers, and they wrote their own hymns and tunes and sang them in the marketplace.
So here you are writing books as well, and improving yourself, as you say. So tell me about the books that you've published.
Well, I mean, probably I'm best known for writing a book called The Slums of Leicester, which is all about the parts of Leicester which are no longer there, about the 16,000 or so houses which were demolished really between 1932, the break for the war, and 1975. So lots of streets don't exist anymore. I mean, streets like Palmerston Street or well, Charnwood Street, I suppose, is best known. That it's the one that people still remember, but there are a lot of other streets which have entirely disappeared and been replaced. And of course, that was a revolution in people's housing, moving from one up, one down houses out onto the estates. I mean, the thing is that there was in 1990s there was very little record of where people had lived. I mean, I by luck had been given a collection of photographs showing houses which had been knocked down in the 1930s, and I then found some descriptions of those streets written by a man in the 1890s, and put the two together, the photographs and the descriptions, and conjured a book out of it. So it described those areas, which are, of course, now long gone, and yes, and probably not even in people's memories anymore.
So, Ned, have you done talks as well as written books? Do you speak to people or schools or other society groups?
Yes, I do. I shall be doing one fairly soon in Weekston about the poor law in Leicester and people's reaction to the poor law in Leicester. I mean, the three riots in Leicester, one in 1842, one in 1848, and another one in 1921, which were riots against the requirements of the poor law to people in order to get benefit, they would have had to go on into the workhouse. And people didn't want to go into the workhouse. And sometimes when they were in the workhouse, they were put to a task. And in 1842, that would have been a treadmill, a mill, which they had to turn to grind flour out of corn. And they had to do that for a very long period. Or breaking rocks, that was another favourite in the workhouse. So people got a little bit up in arms over having to do those tasks when sometimes they weren't physically able to do it.
The good old days, eh?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Pretty. I mean, the difficulty in 1848 was that people would be made to break rocks when they were used to sitting down being framework knitters and didn't have the physical capacity to wield a hammer in the way that maybe somebody who was used to earning their living digging ditches and so forth might have done. So yes, that was a real problem.
Yes. So the other day I learnt about the riots at Victoria Park in 1864, I think it was, the hot air balloon. Tell me, do you know about that? I'd be fascinated to hear more about that if you know about it, Ned.
I know very little more than you about the hot air incident, a bizarre incident. But there were other things that happened in Victoria Park that were of interest. I mean, for instance, in 1856, a band played music on Victoria Park on a Sunday, which was slightly regarded as being sacrilegious by some, because everything shut on Sundays, and there was a big movement to shut all pubs on Sundays, shut everything down, including the bakeries where people had their lunches. And the band that played there in 1856 played there in 1857, because although the land was owned by the council, it was leased to the racecourse, who then I think had a sublease to the publican of the Old Horse Pub, used to graze cattle in. And there wasn't quite a law outlawing music on a Sunday on the park, and eventually the people who ran the band were fined £1 for trespass, and there was no music on Victoria Park until about 1896, when they built a bandstand. So that was Leicester in the 19th century. Yes. Everything shut on Sunday.
And they just built a new bandstand?
Yes, about time too.
Okay, thank you, Ned. That was fascinating. I'd like to hear more. So I'm with Tom from St. Philip's Centre, Memories of Living Well Together, an oral history project.
So we began by recording the memories of 30 people who moved to Leicester from overseas, their experiences of being welcomed and arriving in Leicester, what was good and what was bad. And as we chatted about that with different people and shared, the feedback was that it was great to hear about migrants from overseas, but what about people who'd lived in Leicester all their lives as well?
Yes.
So we expanded our project and we've interviewed 103 people, roughly a third of whom were born in a country other than the UK, a third of whom were born in the UK but not in Leicester, and a third were born in Leicester itself. And what we're doing now is having a look at what they've said, trying to spot some themes and common characteristics and ideas, and getting ready to put an exhibition on in Leicester Museum next February.
Well, that's quite... So how many people in all did you interview?
So across the pilot and the main project, 133. So quite a good number, I think.
Yes. And Tom, can you just say what kind of questions did you ask, and was there anything particular that came out of doing this research that you perhaps didn't know about or were interested in?
So we asked people about their experiences and what was good, what was bad, what they enjoyed about Leicester, and I think... One of the things I'm really taking away is a lot of people said Leicester has so much to celebrate, but it's very bad about shouting about itself. You know, there was a lot of noise around the football in 2016 and about the King, but there's not been a lot of noise since then. But actually, so many good things have happened. Why aren't we a bit more proud of our city and more prepared to tell the rest of the world about how good we are?
And was there anything particular that people said about what they're proud about their city? Was there a theme, or was it just generally about what people said?
I think what came across was that Leicester is really good at welcoming people in. I mean, obviously there are exceptions and some people aren't as happy with the changes as others. But by and large, people feel that even if they're the only person from their part of the world, you know, maybe they don't know anyone else who's moved to Leicester from Vanuatu or from Taiwan or from wherever they've come from. Because there are so many people from so many parts of the world, it's fine. Somebody said, you see the world here and no one finds you strange. Which I thought was a lovely way of expressing it, that, you know, whatever you look like, however you dress, whatever your ethnicity or religion or worldview, people aren't bothered because they're used to difference, they're used to change, they're used to all kinds of people just making a good life for themselves here in Leicester.
So I'm new to Leicester. I've been here for 3 years, and I'm struck by, you know, superficial impression, but I'm struck by how proud people are of being from Leicester, which I really love about being here.
Yeah, I think I'd say that was true. However long people have been here, once they've got Leicester under their skin, they do feel very proud of it being here. I would say, though, those people who've moved from overseas or from outside Leicester to Leicester sometimes find it a bit hard to get in. The Leicesterfarians, or whatever the right word is, can be a shy bunch, and you need to work maybe a bit harder at making friends with them than you might do in some other parts of the world.
So, Tom, tell me about the purpose of this project that you're doing. What, is there an end aim for the project?
I think our main aim is just to celebrate what's good about Leicester, to hear what people's concerns and worries and fears are, because I think it's important that people get a chance to air those. But maybe to focus on the positive, to talk about what's good about Leicester, how well we get on, how people can feel safe and welcomed and looked after here, and just to celebrate the city and all that's good about it.
Well, that's a very kind of topical theme, isn't it, about celebrating difference and people integrating. So it seems like a really positive thing that you're doing.
Yes, I mean, one of our interviewees talked about that, talking about Leicester having an underdog energy, a desire to make a difference, but maybe not be too loud and proud about it. And he also said he thought that people were really concerned that Leicester remains a welcoming and inclusive space. And if people tried to come and disrupt that, then the people of Leicester would rise up against them in a polite but firm way, tell them to leave.
So sort of the equivalent of writing a very stiff letter when you're a bit annoyed about something.
Yes, yeah, something like that. I don't think people would be violent or aggressive. I think they'd just politely say, no, we don't want your kind here, off you go.
So Tom, if people wanted to find out more about what you're doing with this research, how would they go about doing that?
If they can get on the internet, look up St. Philip's Centre, stphillipscentre.co.uk, and drop me a line there, and we'd be very happy to get talk to them about what we're doing. We'd love to share our findings with any groups or organisations that want to hear more about what we've done.
And what is St. Philip's? Is it just you, or are there other people involved?
We're a charity that's been around since 2006. Our main aim is to help people understand different religion and belief worldviews, to build relationships across difference, to help people understand and cooperate with each other for the good of the city. There's about six or seven of us on the staff team, and then we have a pool of about 50 or 60 volunteers who work with us.
So you're non-denominational. You're not. You don't have any affiliations to any other group. You're just an independent group. Is that right?
Yeah, so we're an independent charity. Our history is Christian. We were set up as an ecumenical initiative of a number of Christian groups. But now we're our own thing, and we work with people of all kinds of different worldviews and perspectives.
Thank you, Tom. That was really fascinating. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
So I'm with Russell from Grow Social Capital. So Russell, tell me something about your group and what it is you do.
Hello, Roger. Andy and I, my colleague at Grow Social Capital, a social enterprise, we're in Leicester. My first ever visit to Leicester, actually, yesterday. And we're just promoting a few different projects that we've got. One is a pocket museum, where communities curate their own museum in their pocket, like a deck of cards, and they identify through a process of maybe sharing stories, deliberation, community engagement, consultation, the 50 things that tell their community story. So that might be a community of place, a district in Leicester, for example. It could be a community of identity, maybe a particular ethnic group in a locality, or it could be shared interests, so it could be something to do with faith or class or a football club or whatever it might be. So we've done that in East End of London around Cockney identity. We've done it in the district of Splott in Cardiff, which is where we're based. And there's some interest and appetite from some communities in Leicester about maybe doing something similar here.
So Splott, that's a great name.
It is. And there's no consensus around the origins of it. And that's actually the very first item in that pocket museum. Its first recorded instance is 1440. And like I said, there's no consensus. So some think it might originate from the Welsh word, ysblad. Others think it's a corruption or like a derivation of God's own plot. There's also one version that it's the sound your feet make when you step into the mud on the channel, because it's right on the coast on the Bristol Channel.
So your visit to Leicester, because Leicester's very diverse, it's got different groups of people, it's obviously got Richard III and other things which mostly people associate with Leicester. So are there common themes about Leicester that you might be able to do in this project?
I mean, I suppose if people want to raise those themes, then yes. So in one respect, I'm not really bothered what ends up in the pocket museum. The process is more important. People coming together, yes, building. We tend to reject the word cohesion. It just feels a bit clunky. It's about togetherness and about being inquisitive about ourselves, yes, and each other. And what we would suggest is if people want to spend time with one another, exploring some of these issues, and those themes emerge that are common across ethnic groups, faith groups, class, identity, language, whatever it might be, then great. And then what would be the objects? What would be the objects? I don't know whether it's landmarks, whether it's instances, events of the past, famous sons and daughters of a particular district. So in Splott, they're very proud of Clive Sullivan. Clive Sullivan is the first person of colour to captain any British or home nation sporting team when he captained the Great Britain Rugby League team in 1971. And they're proud of Clive. He's died tragically young in his 40s, back in the 80s. But that's a pioneer, not just was a great rugby player, but he was a pioneer in terms of ethnic diversity within sport and captaining a British rugby league team. So that's great. In Splott, they're also proud that Craig Bellamy, the current Wales team manager in football, is a Splott boy originally. Well, that's great. We're not sort of saying, let's not celebrate Craig because he's white, and let's only celebrate Clive. But we can use Clive, whose parents came from the Caribbean and settled in Cardiff in the 30s, we can use Clive as a kind of like a gateway, if you like, into discussing race and the fact that actually people of colour have been in Cardiff for years, I mean, like well over 100 years, close to 150 years, because it's a docks town. So of course it was. And it was the greatest coal exporting dock in the world at one point in terms of volume of coal. And where was that coal going? It was going to Aden, it was going to Yemen, it was going to Egypt, it was going to all over the place. So that's why people of colour settled in Cardiff. Well, Clive is a gateway into that. So yeah, and you can use lots of different, like I said, objects, yes, landmarks, cultural motifs, ways of speaking, all sorts of different things.
So it's the story of Leicester in 50 objects, is that right? 50?
It could be the story of Braunston, it could be the story of Evington, it could be the story of... if people would like to. So yeah, this kind of, we're here celebrating this concept. We've got to know John Costa, Rob Watson, and they sort of said, we've got this heritage fair. This project is obviously heritage themed. We think heritage is a good way of actually building social capital, which is kind of a more our broader kind of purpose and mission, is to, yes, raise awareness of that, yes, and recognise its value. Heritage is a great way of doing that because it's, again, very, very narrative-based. It's very people are very passionate about their heritage, which is great. And usually there's an inquisitiveness on the part of somebody to explore that heritage. So what we're saying is, well, let's build that social capital. Let's celebrate togetherness, build that as well, but using maybe heritage-related projects such as that pocket museum. But if people wanted to do the story of Leicester in 50 objects, well, Richard III would be one, I guess. The Premier League win the other year would be another one. Leicester Tigers, but we're learning about, is it Elizabeth Hawkins? Have I got that name right? The
suffragette.
The suffragette,
yes.
Yeah.
I just interviewed someone who is their grandson.
Right, well, there we go. So she is someone I'd never heard of before.
Yes.
But I now know, the next time I hear about the suffragette movement, I'll be thinking of Miss Hawkins in Leicester, that visit I made. So it's kind of that what it's all about, really.
Yes.
But I'm sure there's probably something that someone else in Leicester could say to that young man that he didn't know about. And so we just build up that knowledge, and we recognise that, you know, often it's people who've contributed to these who've come from, you know, other lands. They speak other languages, they have other faiths and all that kind of thing, really. So, yeah.
And if someone wanted to get hold of you or contact you, how's the best to do that?
Well, our website's www.growsocialcapital.org.uk, or email us hello@growsocialcapital.org.uk. We're on the usual social media platforms as well. And we'd love to speak to people if they're interested in getting involved in a project that's Leicester-based. We'd probably work through John and likes of John and Rob, or other local organisations, of which there are dozens here today. Because what we wouldn't want to do is to come in. You know, we don't want to kind of parachute in, but we can help build the apparatus and infrastructure around a project that can be very deliberative. The idea is actually it takes time. So it's not like a fast food thing. Let's quickly do a heritage project. No, let's do it slowly and deliberatively and learn along the way. So, maybe next year, John mentioned a bit earlier, at 10th Heritage Fair, so maybe next year we can be curating, or having curated, a pocket museum for Leicester or parts of Leicester. And we could be celebrating that this time next year, maybe.
Okay, Russell, thanks for speaking to us.
Hello, I'm with Bert McNeil from the Leicester Civic Society. Welcome, Bert, to the 5th Leicester Saturday Heritage Fair. Please tell me about yourself, the society, and why you're here.
Hi, Harkesh. I'm the chair of the Leicester Civic Society, and it's an organisation, a local organisation of volunteers that have been going since 1971. And we're about loving Leicester, local people who care about the city and its environs. And we're particularly keen on the buildings that we have, the older buildings, the interesting heritage buildings, and also about new developments that are proposed or taking place. So we come at it without a financial interest of any sort. We are very much volunteers who are looking at things in terms of the value they are to the people of Leicester. So when we come up against, say, the council or private developers, we have an independent voice. And we try and protect the older buildings and make sure that there's some good quality about modern developments as well, and that they enhance the city, add to it, rather than being poor value for the future. I think our strap line is campaigning for a better Leicester. So that opens up much more than just buildings and the environment. It talks about life in Leicester as well. And we do care about that. And I think that is very significant about the life of the city for the people of Leicester. And that really is a driver, particularly for me, that we can feel all people in Leicester, from whatever background, whatever walk of life, can feel engaged in the city and feel proud to be here. And we can, community cohesion is so important, but just a real joy of this. We have our one life, we think, and you know, we can pull it together and keep enjoying it together. And I think where we live, it is so important. There is elements of negativity. I think we all realise that about the city and about the city centre. But I think it's absolutely essential that somehow we do all come together. It represents, it should represent all of us, and we should be in a more friendly society where we pull together and support the city. It sounds a little bit ambiguous and theoretical in a sense, and I guess it always will be, but we need to have that pride, and that's one of the big things that we work on as well.
That's great. So civic architecture and buildings, of course, very important to our environment, to our urban landscape, but you went on quite quickly to people. Mm. So tell us a little bit about that. What difference does it make? Why is it important about personal, social history, and so on?
A place, yes, it's not just buildings, bricks, mortar, concrete. What brings a place alive is the people who are there, and what they are, what make it so important. And one of our things is social history, but also the social future, I think, that we're trying to build. But certainly the stories of each individuals and from different communities, and taking that forward, it's going to be so important. And I think we all know that wherever we are and wherever we come from, that we do feel part of something altogether. And I mean, you can see it perhaps in football crowds, that representation. I know there can be negative connotations with that, but I think there's also, it's bringing about a spirit which, I mean, we've got to be careful with this, where you see nationalism and it can be worrying, and when it can be hateful. That's why we need, and I see almost like a kind of patriotism, but in the sense of a pride amongst all of us, and a pride that we can extend in a friendly way to others, that brings it together.
That's really interesting, this idea of civic pride as opposed to national patriotism. And civic pride, we can be proud of our city while recognising that things could be better in our city and in our country. And for me, that is the essence of patriotism. I love my country, but I know it can be better. It's a progressive view. What do you think?
I think you've summed it up perfectly, Harkish. Yeah, better than I could in a way. Yes, it could be better. And we campaign to try and improve things around Leicester in many ways, and we looked within our own organisation to try and expand our membership and our reach with all communities in Leicester. It's so important, old, young, all walks of life, and that is going to be crucial as we go forward. And I think we all recognise that the importance of that. And I mean, one of the things is we live in a society which does tend to divide us somewhat through the way we operate. It's not as easy to get on and be looked. I mean, we have great institutions and support systems, but there is a real sense of you stand alone a lot in this world now. And I think we need a bit more joining up as in a friendly way of, dare I say, more socialist approach to things. I mean, I'm a mixed economy person myself. The value of being able to choose and etc. But we need a backup that I think pulls us all together, and as a thread that runs between us all in of kindness, which it is idealistic, but that's where I'm aiming for.
I was just about to say it's a real good combination of idealism and pragmatism. Yes. To accept that we live in a mixed economy, and to make it work for people as best as it can.
Indeed, yes. And we sort of look towards doing that and celebrating the city, Leicester, in general. We run a whole series of walks every year and other events. And these celebrate different aspects of Leicester. There's one on the 18th of October, which my colleague James Gunn is leading, Meet at Curve, and he's walking through the Wharf Street area around there. So this is, we're not just looking at the old Victorian historic buildings, but the social, the change that is happening across the city, and is happening right as we speak. It's a really ever-developing, ever-changing world and city. And so that would be absolutely fascinating if you're interested. So all details are on our website.
That's great. I was about to say yes. So listeners, do go to the Civic Society website and find out about their events and their talks and their guided walks. And all I have to say now is, Bert, we could go on talking about Civic Leicester, but I'm going to hand over to you to have the last word. So Bert McNeil from the chair, in fact, of the Leicester Civic Society.
Thanks, Arkesh. And final word, if you're listening and you like some of the ramble that I've been on and feel like you might like to get involved, we'd love to have more people involved. And I don't mean just sort of joining as the members, but getting involved, having your say, doing things. If you've got a love for Leicester and want to see it get better, come and join us. There's loads we can do, which could be absolutely brilliant. So check the website, email me. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hello, this is Rob Watson at the Saturday Heritage Fair in Leicester for Sore Sound, and I'm joined by somebody who I've not learnt their name yet. Tell me who you are.
My name is Meg Nicol, and I know you, Rob, because I've already listened to some of your podcasts.
Oh, right. Okay, yeah. Great.
Which is really good.
Right. Oh, that's strange.
Well, yeah, that's very odd. You have a reputation, you
so
see.
What brings you to the Saturday Heritage Fair?
Well, I'm really excited to reintroduce Leicester to someone called Lawrence Wright. I don't know if you've heard of him or not, but he was born in Leicester in 1888, and he died in 1964 it was. And basically, he was a songwriter and a music publisher, and he set up the Melody Maker in 1926. And next year is the 100th year of the Melody Maker.
Wow.
Yeah. So I'm here to talk about it.
And why did he base the experience from his experience of being in Leicester? What's the connection then?
Okay. So basically what it was, his dad started in Leicester as a shoe clicker. And he was born, when he was born, his dad was working in the factories in Leicester, but the family were always really interested in music. And he learned the fiddle and the mandolin and piano. And then, in fact, the job his dad did actually earned him quite a lot of money in the factory. And he went on to open a music shop in Conduit Street in Leicester. And they had a blue plaque there at one time, but I went to try and find it, and it wasn't there, and I was really disappointed about that, because I'm a songwriter myself, and so I have an interest in songs and in publishers and that sort of thing, yeah, in the music industry.
And what's your connection with this, then? How have you got into it?
Well, now, if I told you about that, it might take quite a long time, but in actual fact, I was at, because I'm involved with the music industry and I am a songwriter, and I was at a music industry dinner, and I sat beside this elderly man, and I happened to say to him, I said, well, why are you here? You know, what are you doing? And he said, I'm a hit songwriter. Now, he was 90 years old, and he told me that his dad had been a hit songwriter at the turn of the century, and that he'd written songs with someone called Lawrence Wright, who was, in fact, used a pen name of Horatio Nichols. And they wrote songs like Are We Downhearted? No, the kind of wartime songs, you know.
Edwardian type of that
kind of thing. And it was so interesting to me hearing him talk. And he said, and by the way, he said, I'm actually a hit songwriter myself. And I'm thinking, this is extraordinary. I'm sitting next to this man, you know, he's 90. And he's telling me he's a hit songwriter. And he said, I used to work for Lawrence Wright. And he said, and I worked for him as a wrap-up boy in Blackpool. This guy is incredible. He was such an entrepreneur and started, you know, his own publishing business by just going to London with a barrow and sheet music. And he went to Denmark Street.
Has there not been a movie made about this? Because that sounds... it's incredible. A fantastic screenplay.
Well, you're absolutely right. And in actual fact, I ended up doing a documentary about this old gentleman and his dad. And he was such a... You know, in those days they had... In the 50s and things, they had song pluggers who went out there and really pushed the songs. And this man I'm talking to was also a song plugger. And he told me that that he would make sure that people listened to this program. And I'm thinking, how's he going to do that? Because this is a documentary for Radio 2 I did. And anyway, he got 75 fan letters from that documentary. And he said to me, if you think that was good, well, he's now 93.
So what was the story with Lawrence setting up the Melody Maker? How did that come about?
Well, because...
I know this is all like whistle stop through everything.
I know,
but, it's fascinating.
It is. It's incredible. It's well, he set up every time something different happened, because the music industry doesn't stand still. Not for a minute. You know, you've got 3 weeks is a long time in the music industry. And then it was quite extraordinary because... If you think about it, he was in London just prior to the First World War. So he then realized music wasn't going to be selling in London. So he went to Blackpool, where people were...
Go on holiday.
Where they go on holiday.
And pick up a tune. And they,
exactly. Yeah. But, and also, they're selling sheet music, remember. And he started something called a song shop, where songwriters, singers would sing the songwriters' songs and the public would buy, you know. So that's what he did. And on a good day, even in those days, they could take as much as £2,000.
Wow.
Which is incredible.
Yeah.
And my friend, this 90-year-old, he actually was a wrap-up boy in one of those song shops. And that's how he got started.
What's
with Lawrence
Wright. Because, I mean, I think that might mean something different now, right?
A wrap-up boy in those days was, he was wrapping up the sheet music and taking the money.
Right, okay.
Yeah, so that was his job. But what would happen would be, as soon as a large crowd came along the prom, they would start singing. And, you know, they would then sell the sheet music, because how else do you hear music in those days? The music was heard via music hall artists. You know, so
now it's all algorithms with Spotify and Apple.
I know,
YouTube and
very difficult. And do you know? Because I did some research on this, and this just might be interesting to your listeners, that a songwriter in 1912 was making more money than a songwriter can make today.
Well, that's no surprise, because most songwriters are at the bottom of the heap. There's a few, you know, the Elton Johns, the Queens.
Yes.
They make a bit of money, but
they're in the past. I don't mean in the past, but they've done all the earnings, you know, from 20 years ago, kind of thing.
And everybody else is struggling to survive.
Exactly. Yeah, you know, we're all ducking and diving, really.
I mean, there is a big, one of the big things on the government's agenda is the AI.
I know.
And copyright issues around this.
Exactly.
I was at an event last week, and a lot of the publishing organisations were there, and they're only there to protect the big catalogues. They're not there to support the small independent songwriters and musicians and performers. So
no.
I think it's we can learn a lot from, although it mightn't have been less well protected in 100 years ago, now it's maybe not any better.
No, it's true. But except 100 years ago, though, they actually still had things like pirating. I mean, people were still pirating. So if you were buying a piece of sheet music for sixpence or something, there was somebody who was going to do a copy for two pence or something like that. And so they had a lot of piracy problems. in those days.
So what are you doing here now? What's the today?
What am I doing? Oh, good point. Today I'm doing a talk on Lawrence Wright and about the music industry at that time. But also, what I really want to know, if there's anybody out there in Leicester that knows where his blue plaque has gone.
Have you spoken to the Civic Society people in the Leicester history?
No. Okay, where are they?
So Sue Leicester in the main hall. Leicester, what are they called? I was trying to get the name right. Family History Society. They know everything. All sorts of stuff. Well worth having a chat to.
I will definitely go there then, because I think it's really important. And I'm working with people now who were trying to get a play of his life story.
When you found out a bit more, come and talk to us again on Source.
Thank you so much. It's lovely to be here. Thank you, Rob.
My next guest is Phil from Mace, M-A-C-E. Hello, Phil.
Hello. I'm from Mace, which stands for the Media Archive for Central England. We're the regional film archive for the East and West Midlands. We're here at the Heritage Fair today, showing some of the old films that we've collected over the years from Leicester. So we've got a compilation of films running, and they're films that over the last 20 years or so the organisation has been in operation to collect and preserve and then make accessible film and video relating to the central part of England, so the Midlands, both East and West Midlands.
That's great. Do you have any favourite films or a favourite period of civic history that's shown on film?
Well, I think I really like finding the films that are as old as possible, because we often find, people find in their attics, they find old films that maybe their parents have shot or their grandparents. And I think it's fascinating to look back at something that may have been shot 100 years ago and to see what life was like, even just down to details of the clothes people wore, what they did, you know, where they went on holiday, the cars people had. A lot of people, of course, didn't have cars at all. Just those cultural changes that have happened over the last century. I think always endlessly fascinating.
Can you tell us a little bit about the film archive from Leicester, or about Leicester? Any particular films that come to mind? Any footage?
Well, probably the best place to go if anybody, you know, wants to check out films of Leicester is going on our website, which is macearchive.org. We've got a really easy to use search box, and you could type in Leicester, and it's going to be hundreds of films people can look at. But one of my favourites is really probably about the earliest we've got, which shows a group of children who were going on a holiday to Mablethorpe from Leicester, and they were underprivileged children, and there was a local council fundraising and to show them going out for some holiday weekend in Mablethorpe in 1920, and that's over 100 years ago now.
That's amazing. I believe there was a premises of a charity linked to fundraising for children to go to Mablethorpe, and that building is in the centre of Leicester. It might still be there, or it might now be an antiques place. Have you heard of that at all?
Yeah, I know where the organisation. Yeah, the film is called Leicester Poor Boys and Girls, but the charity still exists now, and it's known as Mosaic.
Thank you, Phil. I have to ask this question because I'm representing the Friends of Ebbington and the Ebbington Echo. Do you have any film at all connected with Ebbington?
You've put me on the spot a bit there. I'm sure we have got some film of Ebbington. As I said, you know, people want to go on the website, have a look, see what we've got. And, of course, if there's anybody, you know, listening to this and they've got their own films and video, we want to get them preserved in a public archive, you know, come and talk to us.
We'll put out an appeal in the Ebbington Echo for original footage from the past about Ebbington. I know we have shared many photographs of old Ebbington going back many, many years, and maybe that out there are people with video footage, so we'll certainly put them in touch with your organisation, with Mace.
Thank you very much. Yeah, that would be fantastic. And then maybe at a future event like this, we could show some of those films that have been discovered.
Thank you so much, Phil, from Mace.
No problem. Thanks very much.
Welcome to the fifth Saturday Heritage Fair being held at Leicester Adult Education College. I'm Harkesh Sharma, a community reporter for the Evington Echo and a trustee of a charity called the Friends of Evington. There is an eclectic range of exhibitors, volunteers and speakers here today, all eager to share their enthusiasm for their special interests. I suppose it's all about sharing private and professional passions with the public. And I'm delighted that my first guest is Sue Lester, who will introduce herself more and tell us why she's here at the Saturday Heritage Fair. And maybe later on, Sue, we might be able to reminisce a little bit about school times, because listeners, Sue was also my English teacher. But we'll talk about that later. Less about me now, more about Sue and her organisation.
Yeah, hi, thanks for inviting me along. Right, so my name's Sue Lester and I'm the Publicity Officer for Leicestershire and Rutland Family History Society. We're an organisation that's been going 50 years. We're actually in our 51st year. And we're kind of set up to help people research their family history, primarily Leicestershire and Rutland. But we also now, with the advent of the internet, can help people research a lot more widely. So, for instance, if you haven't got ancestors from Leicester itself, we can help with researching for most of Britain. Slightly more difficult researching overseas, but not impossible. I don't know what else you want to say at this point.
I've got a question. You accompany people in on their journey to find out about their ancestors, I'm sure, and that you probably have some examples. But a general question, how does it change a person, or what is the benefit of finding out about somebody from generations before? What do you think? What have people said to you, and how have they changed, if they have changed at all, once they have discovered their ancestors?
I'm not necessarily sure I'd use the word benefit, but I think it's very rewarding and illuminating to find just what one's ancestors did. I mean, often we know about parents. Not everybody knows about parents and their lives. If you go back another generation to grandparents, a lot of people don't really know about their lives. And finding out how they worked and lived and their living conditions and how many children they had. There's one particular interesting census, for instance, the 1911 census, that tells you how many children have been born to a couple. But it also tells you quite poignantly how many of those children are still alive and how many sadly died, probably as a result of infant mortality. Now, some people will have said, well, I knew my grandparents. I didn't know they had four children that died. And it makes you see ancestors in a different light. We've also had people come along and say, I know I had an aunt who died as a baby. Would you know where she was buried? We've had someone come along and say, I had a baby sister. I'm in my 80s, this person said. I had a baby sister. I've never known where she was buried. We found the burial, and you could see his eyes filling in tears. I mean, it gives me shivers down my spine just to think about it now. He walked away and came back and said, look, sorry, but look, you don't need to apologise. Yeah. And for him, he'd waited almost all his life to know that. Now, you might not say it's necessarily a benefit, but it can bring peace, it can dig up stories of things you might not want to find out about. It can provide answers, it can leave you with lots of unanswered questions. It's an intriguing journey, it's a bit like a detective journey. So there are many rewards. Some people just do it because they want to get back to William the Conqueror. Personally, I'm not particularly keen to get wanting to do that. I like the idea of, you know, what were the lives of my great-grandparents? You know, what was their daily existence? Where did they live in terms of where they worked? That kind of information. So I think there are lots of different reasons why people come to family history research.
Yes, if I was going to ask that question again, I would use the word reward. This seems to me to be a mixture of personal history and social history as well. if we're only going back a few generations, or even if we go back further. Would you agree that family history research is really a combination of personal history and social history?
Yes, I think particularly one thing we've moved a bit towards, particularly in Leicester, is that people are interested in house history. You know, who lived in my house before me? How many generations back can I go? When was the house built? Some people want to research the history of the road where they lived, find maps of when it didn't exist, when was it built, what are the buildings were, the what churches, where did they worship? Where did they go to school? You know, we've got records of Leicester Borough schools, for instance, that go back to the late 1800s. Because you don't know necessarily where family members went to school. What age did they leave school? You know, were they out to work when they were just 14? So it does show you a lot about the world of work. So in terms of social history, yes. There's also quite an interesting thing you can find out through a probate record. How much money did they leave? You know, and it can be thousands, it can be hundreds, or it can be £20. And it gives you a sense of, you know, how were they coping with their everyday life if all they left was a very small amount of money? So I think you're right. And we have tried to broaden our perspective, if you like, on the ways to research and what you might look for.
So in the age of AI and social media, what are the various sources and resources out there for somebody, you know, in the 21st century looking into their family history? Because I'm sure it's probably changed, hasn't it? And there are a lot more traces and fingerprints and clues out there because it's not just paper records, there are digital records. And tell us a little bit about the sources, please, Sue.
Well, I started searching about 30 years ago when I was still working as a teacher at Judge Meadow, as you've mentioned, and it was pre-internet. Then I had to adjust to, well, not adjust, but I had to take on the fact that I was going to find out a lot more by using the internet. And there's websites like Ancestry, heavily advertised, and Find My Past. And then moving on in the last 10, 20 years since DNA developments, it's been possible, obviously, to track down family roots via DNA. Some people have had slightly unfortunate and unnerving experiences through DNA. There's been a lot on television, obviously, recently, with Professor Tori King, for instance, DNA Secrets, programmes like that, sometimes with celebrities, sometimes with just the man in the street, the woman in the street. AI is obviously bringing a whole new perspective. It's quite early days for that in terms of what it can offer. People seem quite encouraged by it, but I would say, like anything, you've got to tread carefully. You know, just with Ancestry, you can go down the wrong track and find somebody else has created a tree, but no, that's not the right answer because you've got someone who was baptized in, you know, 1860, and then you've had that they were married in 1861, and you that's possible, but then you might find a burial that just doesn't tie in. So there are dangers, I think, through anything, but it's a great chance to kind of develop the hobby, the passion, if you like. People become very passionate about it. But also, with any kind of research, you've got to just be a little bit cautious and double-check your facts. Go back to sources, original sources, which are available, not just transcriptions and AI information, etc.
That's great. A fascinating insight into researching there. So, obviously, our listeners will be people that visit the Evington Echo website to listen to this podcast and possibly some articles based on interviews today as well. Without naming names, has there been much interest in Evington for family history research? Or tell us about any group that there might be that's involved in that.
Well, I have got a story about Evington research, actually, and it links to Judge Meadow, because I went into Judge Meadow when it was the 11th of November one year to do some military information and to try and talk to people about remembrance. And I looked at the Evington War Memorial, and I looked to see where the soldiers commemorated there had lived. And I took a photograph because one of them lived on Evington Road, and it's a house that is now a solicitor's. So I said to the students, look, why could there be a connection with this building on Evington Road and you? And they said, well, I don't know. And I said, what do you walk past or drive past or come on the bus past every day on your way to school? There's a link with the Evington War Memorial. And they eventually said, well, we kind of got together the idea that this gentleman, who I think was about 19, and he'd been to Wiggiston Collegiate, again a school that they would have been aware of, and he was commemorated on the Evington War Memorial. So I was trying to bring home the idea that there's somebody from your community who's commemorated on that memorial, and have you ever thought about it? I know there is a family history group that meets in the in the cafe in Evington on Wednesdays. Some of us get together on a Monday there, but that's just an informal chat. It's not an organised group.
Tell us about the times and the details of those two groups then, please.
Well, I think the one that meets formally on a Wednesday is probably 10 till 12, but I do know they advertise in the Evington Echo to say when they're meeting up, and there's details about that. I keep meaning to pop along. We're just a very informal group of four friends, really, on Mondays who meet there. I mean, people are welcome to come along and have a quick question, but we're not really set up to do detailed research. We have had a pop-up event there, and maybe that's something we could think about doing in the future.
That's great. And so tell me about the Heritage Fair. Is this the first time you have a stall? It's the Leicester and Rutland Family History Society, isn't it? Yeah. So tell me a little bit about your involvement with previous Heritage Fairs.
We've been coming to all the Heritage Fairs that John Costa has organised. He often has run a military one, so going back pre-lockdown, he organised military history days. And then certainly in 2023, 2024, they started up again. And I think there were one year, I think he had about three different fairs. We ourselves had a very big 50th anniversary fair, which John Costa helped us organise. But there's lots of interesting stalls here today, a really wide range of heritage organisations, and a lot more. It seems a lot busier, actually, this time. It's just bringing different people in. It's city centre, so it's quite easily accessible. You haven't got to go out to, you know, a place which isn't so easy to get to. And there's a nice vibe about the place.
I'd certainly agree with that. There is a very nice vibe, and I really look forward to catching up with other exhibitors and volunteers and speakers as well. So, Sue, our chat about your teaching career and my time at Judge Meadow Community College as a schoolboy will probably have to be a private chat, I think. So we'll have that chat some other time, maybe in the Eden Cafe in Evington. It's been really great to speak to you.
Yeah, thanks. It's been really nice to see you. And I mean, I connected by seeing you in the cafe a few weeks ago, and then I've seen you again several times. And it's always lovely meeting ex-pupils, and particularly if they come up and introduce themselves. I think you used to teach me, and we have a bit of a chat about Judge Meadow. How long did, you know, when did you leave, etc. It's lovely. I love doing it.
Sue Lester, thank you very much.